male hose. Blood sheeted from a gash along his ribs. An arrow fletched with white swan feathers had impaled his right foot and pinned it to the ground, three quarters of the shaft buried in the hard dirt. From the man's throat a horrid, gurgling laugh emanated. It rose and fell with a drunken cadence, pitching from note to note as if the man were about to begin shrieking with horror. "What are you?" shouted King Orin. When the soldier did not immediately respond, the king cursed and said, "Answer me, or I'll let my spellcasters at you! Be you man or beast, or some ill-spawned demon? In what foul pit did Galbatorix find you and your brothers? Are you kin of the Razak?" The king's last question acted like a needle driven into Aragorn. He straightened bolt upright, every sense tingling. The laughter paused for a moment. "Man, I am a man. You are like no man I know. I wanted to assure the future of my family. Is that so foreign to you, Cerdan? Give me no riddles, you fork-tongued wretch. Tell me how you became as you are, and speak honestly, lest you convince me to pour boiling lead down your throat, and see if that pains you." The unbalanced chuckles intensified. Then the soldier said, "You cannot hurt me, Cerdan. No one can. The king himself made us impervious to pain. In return, our families will live in comfort for the rest of their lives. You can hide from us, but we will never stop pursuing you, even when ordinary men would drop dead from exhaustion. You can fight us, but we will continue killing you as long as we have an arm to swing. You cannot even surrender to us, for we take no prisoners. You can do nothing but die and return this land to peace." With a gruesome grimace, the soldier wrapped his mangled shield hand around the arrow and, with the sound of tearing flesh, pulled the shaft out of his foot. Lumps of crimson meat clung to the arrowhead as it came free. The soldier shook the arrow at them, then threw the missile at one of the archers, wounding him in the hand. His laugh louder than ever, the soldier lurched forward, dragging his injured foot behind him. He raised his sword as if he intended to attack. "Shoot him!" shouted Orin. Bowstrings twanged like badly tuned lutes. Then a score of spinning arrows leaped toward the soldier, and an instant later struck him in the torso. Two of the arrows bounced off his gambeson. The remainder penetrated his ribcage. His laughter reduced to a wheezing chuckle as blood seeped into his lungs. The soldier continued moving forward, painting the grass underneath him bright scarlet. The archers shot again, and arrows sprouted from the man's shoulders and arms, but he did not stop. Another volley of arrows followed close upon the last. The soldier stumbled and fell as an arrow split his left kneecap and others skewered his upper legs, and one passed entirely through his neck, punching a hole in his birthmark and whistled out across the field, trailing a spray of blood. And still the soldier refused to die. He began to crawl, dragging himself forward with his arms, grinning and giggling as if the whole world were an obscene joke that only he could appreciate. A cold tingle shivered down Aragorn's spine as he watched. King Orin swore violently, and Aragorn detected a hint of hysteria in his voice. Jumping off his charger, Orin threw his sword and his shield into the dirt, and then pointed at the nearest Urgal. "Give me your axe!" Startled, the grey-skinned Urgal hesitated, then surrendered his weapon. King Orin limped over to the soldier, raised the heavy axe with both hands, and with a single blow chopped off the soldier's head. The giggling ceased. The soldier's eyes rolled and his mouth worked for another few seconds, and then he was still. Orin grasped the head by the hair and lifted it so all could see. "They can be killed," he declared. "Spread the word that the only sure way of stopping these abominations is to behead them, That or bash in their skulls with a mace, or shoot them in the eye from a safe distance. Greytooth, where are you? A stout, middle-aged horseman urged his mount forward. Orin threw him the head which he caught. Mount that on a pole by the north gate of the camp. Mount all of their heads. Let them serve as a message to Galbatorix that we do not fear his underhanded tricks, and we shall prevail in spite of them. Striding back to his charger, Orin returned the axe to the Urgle, then picked up his own weapons. A few yards away, Aragorn spotted Nargajvog standing among a cluster of cull. Aragorn spoke a few words to Saphira, and she sidled over to the Urgles. After exchanging nods, Aragorn asked Gajvog, "Were all the soldiers like that?" He gestured toward the arrow-riddled corpse.
"All men with no pain. You hit them and you think them dead. Turn your back and they hamstring you."
Gajvog scowled.
"I lost many rams today. We have fought droves of humans, Firesword, but never before these laughing ghouls. It is not natural. It makes us think they are possessed by hornless spirits, that maybe the gods themselves have turned against us."
"Nonsense," scoffed Aragorn. "It is merely a spell by Galbatorix, and we shall soon have a way to protect ourselves against it." Notwithstanding his outer confidence, the concept of fighting enemies who felt no pain unsettled him as much as it did the Urgles. Moreover, from what Gajvarg had said, he guessed that maintaining morale among the Vardam was going to be even more difficult for Nasuada once everyone learned about the soldiers. While the Vardan and the Urgles set about collecting their fallen comrades, stripping the dead of useful equipment, and beheading the soldiers, and dragging their truncated bodies into piles to burn, Aragorn, Saphira, and King Orin returned to the camp, accompanied by Arya and the other elves. Along the way, Aragorn offered to heal Orin's leg, but the king refused, saying, "I have my own physicians, Shadeslayer." Nasuada and Jormunda were waiting for them by the north gate. Accosting Orin, Nasuada said,
"What went wrong?"
Aragorn closed his eyes as Orin explained how at first the attack on the soldiers had seemed to go well. The horsemen had swept through their ranks, dealing what they had thought were death blows left and right, and had suffered only one casualty during their charge. When they had engaged the remaining soldiers, however, many of those they had struck down before rose up and rejoined the fight. Orin shuddered. "We lost our nerve then. Any man would have. We did not know if the soldiers were invincible or if they were even men at all. When you see an enemy coming at you with bones sticking out of his calf, a javelin through his belly, and half his face sheared away, and he laughs at you, it's a rare man who can stand his ground. My warriors panicked. They broke formation. It was utter confusion. Slaughter. When the Urgles and your warriors, Nasuada, reached us, they became caught up in the madness." He shook his head. "I've never seen the like of it, not even on the burning plains." Nasuada's face had grown pale, even with her dark skin. She looked at Aragorn and then Arya.
"How could Galbatorix have done this?"
It was Arya who answered.
"Block most, but not all, of a person's ability to feel pain. Leave just enough sensation, so they know where they are and what they are doing, but not so much that pain can incapacitate them. The spell would require only a small amount of energy."
Nasuada wet her lips. Again speaking to Orin, she said,
"Do you know how many we lost?"
A tremor racked Orin. He doubled over, pressed a hand against his leg, gritted his teeth, and growled,
300 soldiers. Against what was the size of the force you sent?"
200 swordsmen, 100 spearmen, 50 archers."
"Those, plus the Urgles, plus my cavalry, say around 1,000 strong. Against 300 foot soldiers on an open field. We slew every last one of the soldiers. What it cost us, though." The king shook his head. We won't know for sure until we count the dead. But it looked to me as if 3/4 of your swordsmen are gone. More of the spearmen, some archers. Of my cavalry few remain, 50, 70. Many of them were my friends. Perhaps 100, 150 Urgals dead. Overall, 500 or 600 to bury, and the better part of the survivors wounded. I don't know. I don't know. I don't. His jaw going slack, Orin slumped to the side and would have fallen off his horse if Arya had not sprung forward and caught him. Nasuada snapped her fingers, summoning 2 of the Varden from among the tents, and ordered them to take Orin to his pavilion, and then to fetch the king his healers.
We have suffered a grievous defeat. No matter that we exterminated the soldiers, Nasuada murmured.
She pressed her lips together, sorrow and despair mixed in equal portions in her expression. Her eyes glimmered with unshed tears. Stiffening her back, she fixed Aragorn and Saphira with an iron gaze.
How fared it with the 2 of you?
She listened without moving while Aragorn described their encounter with Murtagh and Thorn. Afterward, she nodded.
That you would be able to escape their clutches was all we dared hope. However, you accomplished more than that. You proved that Galbatorix has not made Murtagh so powerful that we have no hope of defeating him. With a few more spellcasters to help you, Murtagh would have been yours to do with as you pleased. For that reason, he will not dare confront Queen Islanzadi's army by himself, I think. If we can gather enough spellcasters around you, Aragorn, I believe we can finally kill Murtagh and Thorn the next time they come to abduct the pair of you.
Don't you want to capture them?
Aragorn asked.
I want a great number of things, but I doubt I shall receive very many of them. Murtagh and Thorn may not be trying to kill you, but if the opportunity presents itself, we must kill them without hesitation. Or do you see it otherwise?
No. Shifting her attention to Arya, Nasuada asked,
Did any of your spellweavers die during the contest? Some fainted, but they have all recovered, thank you.
Nasuada took a deep breath and looked northward, her eyes focused on infinity.
Aragorn, please inform Triana that I want Duvrangar Gata to figure out how to replicate Galbatorix's spell. Despicable as it is, we must imitate Galbatorix in this. We cannot afford not to. It won't be practical for all of us to be unable to feel pain. We would hurt ourselves far too easily. But we should have a few hundred swordsmen, volunteers, who are immune to physical suffering.
My lady.
So many dead, said Nasuada.
She twisted her reins in her hands.
We have remained in one place for too long. It is time we forced the Empire onto the defensive again.
She spurred Battlestorm away from the carnage that lay before the camp, the stallion tossing his head and gnawing on his bit.
Your cousin, Aragorn, begged me to allow him to take part in today's fighting. I refused on account of his impending marriage, which pleased him not, although I suspect his betrothed feels otherwise. Would you do me the favor of notifying me if they still intend to proceed with the ceremony today? After so much bloodshed, it would hearten the Varden to attend a marriage.
I will let you know as soon as I find out.
Thank you. You may go now, Aragorn.
The first thing Aragorn and Saphira did upon leaving Nasuada was to visit the elves who had fainted during their battle with Murtagh and Thorn, and thank them and their companions for their assistance. Then Aragorn, Arya, and Blodgarm attended to the hurts Thorn had dealt Saphira, mending her cuts and scratches and a few of her bruises. When they finished, Aragorn located Triana with his mind and conveyed Nasuada's instructions. Only then did he and Saphira seek out Rauron. Blodgarm and his elves accompanied them. Arya left to attend to business of her own. Rauron and Katrina were arguing, quietly and intensely, when Aragorn spotted them standing by the corner of Horst's tent. They fell silent as Aragorn and Saphira drew near. Katrina crossed her arms and stared away from Rauron, while Rauron gripped the top of his hammer thrust through his belt and scuffed the heel of his boot against a rock. Stopping in front of them, Aragorn waited a few moments, hoping they would explain the reason for their quarrel. But instead, Katrina said,
"Are either of you injured?"
Her eyes flicked from him to Saphira and back.
"We were, but no longer."
"That is so strange. We heard tales of magic in Carverhall, but I never really believed them. They seemed so impossible. But here there are magicians everywhere. Did you wound Murtagh and Thorn badly? Is that why they fled?"
"We bested them, but we caused them no permanent harm." Aragorn paused, and when neither Roran nor Katrina spoke, he asked if they still wanted to get married that day.
"Nasawada suggested you proceed, but it might be better to wait. The dead have yet to be buried, and there is much that needs doing. Tomorrow would be more convenient, and more seemly."
"No," said Roran, and ground the tip of his boot against the rock. "The Empire could attack again at any moment. Tomorrow might be too late. If somehow I died before we were wed, what would become of Katrina or our—"
He faltered, and his cheeks reddened.
Her expression softening, Katrina turned to Roran and took his hand. She said,
"Besides, the food has been cooked, the decorations have been hung, and our friends have gathered for our marriage. It would be a pity if all those preparations were for nothing."
Reaching up, she stroked Roran's beard, and he smiled at her, and placed an arm around her.
"I don't understand half of what goes on between them,"
Aragorn complained to Saphira. "When shall the ceremony take place, then?"
"In an hour," said Roran.
Man and Wife. 4 hours later, Aragorn stood on the crest of a low hill dotted with yellow wildflowers. Surrounding the hill was a lush meadow that bordered the Jeet River, which rushed past 100 feet to Aragorn's right. The sky was bright and clear. Sunshine bathed the land with a soft radiance. The air was cool and calm, and smelled fresh, as if it had just rained. Gathered in front of the hill were the villagers from Carverhall, none of whom had been injured during the fighting, and what seemed to be half of the men of the Varden. Many of the warriors held long spears mounted with embroidered pennants of every colour. Various horses, including Snowfire, were picketed at the far end of the meadow. Despite Nasuwada's best efforts, organizing the assembly had taken longer than anyone had reckoned. Wind tousled Aragorn's hair, which was still wet from washing, as Saphira glided over the congregation and alighted next to him, fanning her wings. He smiled and touched her on the shoulder.
"Little one."
Under normal circumstances, Aragorn would have been nervous about speaking in front of so many people and performing such a solemn and important ceremony. But after the earlier fighting, everything had assumed an air of unreality, as if it were no more than a particularly vivid dream. At the base of the hill stood Nasawada, Arya, Nahim, Jormunda, Angela, Elva, and others of importance. King Orin was absent, as his wounds had proved to be more serious than they had first appeared, and his healers were still laboring over him in his pavilion. The king's prime minister, Erwin, was attending in his stead. The only Urgals present were the two in Nasawada's private guard. Aragorn had been there when Nasawada had invited Nar-Garjvog to the event, and he had been relieved when Garjvog had had the good sense to decline. The villagers would never have tolerated a large group of Urgals at the wedding. As it was, Nasawada had difficulty convincing them to allow her guards to remain. With a rustle of cloth, the villagers and the Varden parted, forming a long, open path from the hill to the edge of the crowd. Then, joining their voices, the villagers began to sing the ancient wedding songs of Palancar Valley. The well-worn verses spoke of the cycle of the seasons, of the warm earth that gave birth to a new crop each year, of the spring calving, of nesting robins and spawning fish, and of how it was the destiny of the young to replace the old. One of Blodgam's spellcasters, a female elf with silver hair, withdrew a small gold harp from a velvet case and accompanied the villagers with notes of her own, embellishing upon the simple themes of their melodies, lending the familiar music a wistful mood. With slow, steady steps, Roran and Katrina emerged from either side of the crowd at the far end of the path, turned toward the hill, and, without touching, began to advance toward Aragorn. Roran wore a new tunic he had borrowed from one of the Varden. His hair was brushed, his beard was trimmed, and his boots were clean. His face beamed with inexpressible joy. All in all, he seemed very handsome and distinguished to Aragorn. However, it was Katrina who commanded Aragorn's attention. Her dress was light blue, as befitted a bride at her first wedding, of a simple cut, but with a lace train that was 20 feet long and carried by two girls. Against the pale fabric, her free-flowing locks glowed like polished copper. In her hands was a posy of wildflowers. She was proud, serene, and beautiful. Aragorn heard gasps from some of the women as they beheld Katrina's train. He resolved to thank Nasawada for having Duvrangar Gata make the dress for Katrina, for he assumed it was she who was responsible for the gift. 3 paces behind Roran walked Horst, and at a similar distance behind Katrina walked Birgit, careful to avoid stepping on the train. When Roran and Katrina were halfway to the hill, a pair of white doves flew out from the willow trees lining the Jeet River. The doves carried a circlet of yellow daffodils clutched in their feet. Katrina slowed and stopped as they approached her. The birds circled her 3 times north to east, and then dipped down and laid the circlet upon the crown of her head before returning to the river. "Did you arrange that?" Aragorn murmured to Arya. She smiled. At the top of the hill, Roran and Katrina stood motionless before Aragorn, while they waited for the villagers to finish singing. As the final refrain faded into oblivion, Aragorn raised his hands and said, "Welcome, one and all. Today we have come together to celebrate the union between the families of Roran Garrowson and Katrina Ismira's daughter. They are both of good reputation, and to the best of my knowledge, no one else has a claim upon their hands. If that not be the case, however, or if any other reason exists that they should not become man and wife, then make your objections known before these witnesses, that we may judge the merit of your arguments." Aragorn paused for an appropriate interval, then continued, "Who here speaks for Roran Garrowson?" Horst stepped forward.
"Roran has neither father nor uncle, so I, Horst Ostrichson, speak for him as my blood."
"And who here speaks for Katrina Ismira's daughter?"
Birgit stepped forward.
"Katrina has neither mother nor aunt, so I, Birgit Mardras' daughter, speak for her as my blood. Despite her vendetta against Roran, by tradition it was Birgit's right and responsibility to represent Katrina, as she had been a close friend of Katrina's mother."
"It is right and proper. What, then, does Roran Garrison bring to this marriage, that both he and his wife may prosper?"
"He brings his name," said Horst. "He brings his hammer. He brings the strength of his hands. And he brings the promise of a farm in Carverhall, where they may both live in peace."
Astonishment rippled through the crowd as people realized what Roran was doing. He was declaring in the most public and binding way possible that the Empire would not stop him from returning home with Katrina and providing her with the life she would have had if not for Galbatorix's murderous interference. Roran was staking his honor as a man and a husband on the downfall of the Empire.
"Do you accept this offer, Birgit Mardras' daughter?"
Aragorn asked. Birgit nodded.
"I do."
"And what does Katrina Ismira's daughter bring to this marriage, that both she and her husband may prosper?"
"She brings her love and devotion with which she shall serve Roran Garrison. She brings her skills at running a household, and she brings a dowry.
Surprised, Aragorn watched as Birgit motioned, and two men who were standing next to Nasuada came forward carrying a metal casket between them. Birgit undid the clasp to the casket, then lifted open the lid and showed Aragorn the contents.
He gaped as he beheld the mound of jewelry inside. She brings with her a gold necklace studded with diamonds. She brings a brooch set with red coral from the southern sea and a pearl net to hold her hair. She brings five rings of gold and electrum. The first ring... As Birgit described each item, she lifted it from the casket so all might see she spoke the truth.
Bewildered, Aragorn glanced at Nasuada and noted the pleased smile she wore. After Birgit had finished her litany and closed the casket and fastened the lock again, Aragorn asked,
"Do you accept this offer, Horst Ostrichson?"
"I do."
"Thus your families become one, in accordance with the law of the land." Then for the first time Aragorn addressed Roran and Katrina directly. "Those who speak for you have agreed upon the terms of your marriage. Roran, are you pleased with how Horst Ostrichson has negotiated on your behalf?"
"I am."
"And Katrina, are you pleased with how Birgit Madra's daughter has negotiated on your behalf?"
"I am."
"Roran Stronghammer, son of Garrow, do you swear, then, by your name and by your lineage, that you shall protect and provide for Katrina Ismira's daughter, while you both yet live?"
"I, Roran Stronghammer, son of Garrow, do swear, by my name and by my lineage, that I shall protect and provide for Katrina Ismira's daughter, while we both yet live."
"Do you swear to uphold her honour, to remain steadfast and faithful to her in the years to come, and to treat her with the proper respect, dignity, and gentleness?"
"I swear I shall uphold her honour, remain steadfast and faithful to her in the years to come, and treat her with the proper respect, dignity, and gentleness."
"And do you swear to give her the keys to your holdings, such as they may be, and to your strongbox where you keep your coin, by sunset tomorrow, so she may tend to your affairs as a wife should?"
Roran swore he would.
"Katrina, daughter of Ismira, do you swear by your name and by your lineage that you shall serve and provide for Roran Garrison while you both yet live?"
"I, Katrina, daughter of Ismira, do swear by my name and by my lineage that I shall serve and provide for Roran Garrison while we both yet live."
"Do you swear to uphold his honour, to remain steadfast and faithful to him in the years to come, to bear his children while you may, and to be a caring mother for them?"
"I swear I shall uphold his honour, remain steadfast and faithful to him in the years to come, bear his children while I may, and be a caring mother for them."
"And do you swear to assume charge of his wealth and his possessions, and to manage them responsibly, so he may concentrate upon those duties that are his alone?"
Katrina swore she would. Smiling, Aragorn drew a red ribbon from his sleeve and said,
"Cross your wrists."
Roran and Katrina extended their left and right arms respectively, and did as he instructed. Laying the middle of the ribbon across their wrists, Aragorn wound the strip of satin three times around, and then tied the ends together with a bow knot.
"As is my right as a dragon rider, I now declare you man and wife."
The crowd erupted into cheers. Leaning toward each other, Roran and Katrina kissed, and the crowd redoubled their cheering. Saphira dipped her head toward the beaming couple, and as Roran and Katrina separated, she touched each of them on the brow with the tip of her snout.
"Live long and may your love deepen with every passing year, she said.
Roran and Katrina turned toward the crowd and raised their joined arms skyward.
Let the feast begin, Roran declared.
Aragorn followed the pair as they descended from the hill and walked through the press of shouting people toward two chairs that had been set at the forefront of a row of tables. There Roran and Katrina sat, as the king and queen of their wedding. Then the guests lined up to offer their congratulations and present gifts. Aragorn was first. His grin as large as theirs, he shook Roran's free hand and inclined his head toward Katrina.
Thank you, Aragorn, Katrina said.
Yes, thank you, Roran added.
The honor was mine.
He looked at both of them, then burst out laughing.
What? Demanded Roran. You! The two of you are as happy as fools!
Eyes sparkling, Katrina laughed and hugged Roran.
That we are.
Growing sober, Aragorn said,
You must know how fortunate you are to be here today, together. Roran, if you had not been able to rally everyone and travel to the Burning Plains, and if the Razak had taken you, Katrina, to Urubain, neither of you would have...
Yes, but I did, and they didn't,
interrupted Roran.
Let us not darken this day with unpleasant thoughts about what might have been.
That is not why I mention it.
Aragorn glanced at the line of people waiting behind him, making sure they were not close enough to eavesdrop.
All three of us are enemies of the Empire. And as today has demonstrated, we are not safe even here among the Varden. If Galbatorix can, he will strike at any one of us, including you, Katrina, in order to hurt the others. So I made these for you.
From the pouch at his belt, Aragorn withdrew two plain gold rings, polished until they shone. The previous night he had molded them out of the last of the gold orbs he had extracted from the earth. He handed the larger one to Roran, and the smaller one to Katrina. Roran turned his ring, examining it, then held it up against the sky, squinting at the glyphs in the ancient language carved into the inside of the band.
It's very nice. But how can these help protect us? I enchanted them to do three things, said Aragorn. If you ever need my help, or Saphira's, twist the ring once around your finger and say, Help me, Shadeslayer, help me, Brightscales. And we will hear you, and we will come as fast as we can. Also, if either of you is close to death, your ring will alert us, and you, Roran, or you, Katrina, depending on who is in peril. And so long as the rings are touching your skin, you will always know how to find each other, no matter how far apart you may be.
He hesitated, then added,
I hope you will agree to wear them.
Of course we will, said Katrina.
Roran's chest swelled, and his voice became husky.
Thank you, he said. Thank you. I wish we had had these before she and I were separated in Carverhall.
Since they only had one free hand apiece, Katrina slid Roran's ring on for him, placing it on the third finger of his right hand, and he slid Katrina's on for her, placing it on the third finger of her left hand.
I have another gift for you as well, said Aragorn.
Turning, he whistled and waved. Pushing his way through the crowd, a groom hurried toward them, leading Snowfire by the bridle. The groom handed Aragorn the reins to the stallion, then bowed and withdrew. Aragorn said,
Roran, you will need a good steed. This is Snowfire. He was bronze to begin with, then mine. And now I am giving him to you.
Roran ran his eyes over Snowfire.
He's a magnificent beast. The finest. Will you accept him?
With pleasure.
Aragorn summoned back the groom and returned Snowfire to his care, instructing him that Roran was the stallion's new owner. As the man and horse left, Aragorn looked at the people in line who were carrying presents for Roran and Katrina. Laughing, he said,
The two of you may have been poor this morning, but you'll be rich by this evening.
If Saphira and I ever have a chance to settle down, we'll have to come live with you in the giant hall you will build for all of your children.
Whatever we build, it will hardly be large enough for Saphira, I think, said Roran.
But you will always be welcome with us, said Katrina. Both of you.
After congratulating them once more, Aragorn ensconced himself at the end of a table and amused himself by throwing scraps of roast chicken towards Saphira and watching her snap them out of the air. He remained there until Nasawada had spoken with Roran and Katrina, handing them something small he could not see. Then he intercepted Nasawada as she was departing the festivities.
"What is it, Aragorn?" she asked. "I cannot linger." "Was it you who gave Katrina her dress and her dowry?" "I? Do you disapprove?" "I'm grateful you were so kind to my family, but I wonder—" "Yes? Isn't the Varden desperate for gold?" "We are," Nasawada said, "but not so desperate as before. Since my scheme with the lace, and since I triumphed in the trial of the Long Knives, and the wandering tribes swore absolute fealty to me, and granted me access to their riches, we are less likely to starve to death, and more likely to die because we don't have a shield or a spear."
Her lips twitched in a smile.
"What I gave Katrina is insignificant compared with the vast sums this army requires to function. And I do not believe I have squandered my gold. Rather, I believe I have made a valuable purchase. I have purchased prestige and self-respect for Katrina, and by extension I have purchased Roran's goodwill. I may be overly optimistic, but I suspect his loyalty will prove far more valuable than 100 shields or 100 spears. You are always seeking to improve the Varden's prospects, aren't you?" Aragorn said. "Always. As you should be."
Nasawada started to walk away from him,
then returned and said, "Sometime before sunset, come to my pavilion, and we will visit the men who were wounded today. There are many we cannot heal, you know. It will do them good to see that we care about their welfare, and that we appreciate their sacrifice."
Aragorn nodded.
"I will be there."
"Good."
Hours passed as Aragorn laughed and ate and drank and traded stories with old friends. Mead flowed like water, and the wedding feast became ever more boisterous. Clearing a space between the tables, the men tested their prowess against one another with feats of wrestling and archery, and bouts with quarterstaves. Two of the elves, a man and a woman, demonstrated their skill with swordplay, awing the onlookers with the speed and grace of their dancing blades, and even Arya consented to perform a song, which sent shivers down Aragorn's spine. Throughout, Roran and Katrina said little, preferring to sit and gaze at each other, oblivious to their surroundings. When the bottom of the orange sun touched the distant horizon, however, Aragorn reluctantly excused himself. With Saphira by his side, he left the sounds of revelry behind and walked to Nasawada's pavilion, breathing deeply of the cool evening air to clear his head. Nasawada was waiting for him in front of her red command tent. The Nighthawks gathered close around. Without saying a word, she, Aragorn and Saphira made their way across the camp to the tents of the healers where the injured warriors lay. For over an hour, Nasawada and Aragorn visited with the men who had lost their limbs or their eyes, or had contracted an incurable infection in the course of fighting the Empire. Some of the warriors had been injured that morning. Others, as Aragorn discovered, had been wounded on the burning plains and had yet to recover, despite all the herbs and spells lavished upon them. Before they had set forth among the rows of blanket-covered men, Nasawada had warned Aragorn not to tire himself further by attempting to heal everyone he met. But he could not help muttering a spell here and there, to ease pain or to drain an abscess, or to reshape a broken bone, or to remove an unsightly scar. One of the men Aragorn met had lost his left leg below the knee, as well as two fingers on his right hand. His beard was short and grey, and his eyes were covered with a strip of black cloth.
when Aragorn greeted him and asked how he fared. The man reached out and grasped Aragorn by the elbow with the three fingers of his right hand. In a hoarse voice, the man said,
"Ah, Shadeslayer, I knew you would come. I have been waiting for you ever since the light."
"What do you mean?"
"The light that illuminated the flesh of the world. In a single instant, I saw every living thing around me. From the largest to the smallest, I saw my bones shining through my arms. I saw the worms in the earth and the gore crows in the sky and the mites on the wings of the crows. The gods have touched me, Shadeslayer. They gave me this vision for a reason. I saw you on the field of battle, you and your dragon, and you were like a blazing sun among a forest of dim candles. And I saw your brother and his dragon, and they too were like a sun."
The nape of Aragorn's neck prickled as he listened.
"I have no brother," he said.
The maned swordsman cackled.
"You cannot fool me, Shadeslayer. I know better. The world burns around me, and from the fire I hear the whisper of minds, and I learn things from the whispers. You hide yourself from me now, but I can still see you, a man of yellow flame with 12 stars floating around your waist, and another star brighter than the others upon your right hand."
Aragorn pressed his palm against the belt of Beloth the Wise, checking that the 12 diamonds sewn within were still concealed. They were.
"Listen to me, Shadeslayer,"
whispered the man, pulling Aragorn toward his lined face.
"I saw your brother, and he burned. But he did not burn like you. Oh, no. The light from his soul shone through him, as if it came from somewhere else. He was a void, a shape of a man, and through that shape came the brilliance that burned. Do you understand? Others illuminated him."
"Where were these others? Did you see them as well?"
The warrior hesitated.
"I could feel them, close at hand, raging at the world as if they hated everything in it. But their bodies were hidden from my sight. They were there and not there. I cannot explain better than that. I would not want to get any closer to those creatures, Shadeslayer. They aren't human, of that I'm sure. And their hate, it was like the largest thunderstorm you've ever seen, crammed into a tiny glass bottle."
"And when the bottle breaks," Aragorn murmured.
"Exactly, Shadeslayer. Sometimes I wonder if Galbatorix has managed to capture the gods themselves and make them his slaves. But then I laugh and call myself a fool."
"Whose gods, though? The dwarves? Those of the wandering tribes?"
"Does it matter, Shadeslayer? A god is a god, regardless of where he comes from."
Aragorn grunted. "Perhaps you're right." As he left the man's pallet, one of the healers pulled Aragorn aside. She said,
"Forgive him, my lord. The shock of his wounds has driven him quite mad. He's always ranting about suns and stars and glowing lights he claims to see. Sometimes it seems as if he knows things he shouldn't. But don't you be deceived. He gets them from the other patients. They gossip all the time, you know. It's all they have to do, poor things."
"I am not a lord," Aragorn said, "and he is not mad. I'm not sure what he is, but he has an uncommon ability. If he gets better or worse, please inform one of Duvrangar Gata."
The healer curtsied.
"As you wish, Shadeslayer. I'm sorry for my mistake, Shadeslayer."
"How was he hurt?"
"A soldier cut off his fingers when he tried to block a sword with his hand. Later, one of the missiles from the Empire's catapults landed upon his leg, crushing it beyond repair. We had to amputate. The men who were beside him said that when the missile struck,
he immediately began screaming about the light, and when they picked him up, they noticed that his eyes had turned pure white. Even his pupils have disappeared.
Ah, you have been most helpful. Thank you. It was dark when Aragorn and Nasawada finally left the healer's tents. Nasawada sighed and said,
"Now I could use a mug of mead."
Aragorn nodded, staring down between his feet. They started back to her pavilion, and after a while she asked,
"What are you thinking, Aragorn?" "That we live in a strange world, and I'll be lucky if I ever understand more than a small portion of it."
Then he recounted his conversation with the man, which she found as interesting as he had.
"You should tell Arya about this," said Nasawada. "She might know what these others could be."
They parted at her pavilion, Nasawada going inside to finish reading a report, while Aragorn and Saphira continued on to Aragorn's tent. There, Saphira curled up on the ground and prepared to sleep, as Aragorn sat next to her and gazed at the stars, a parade of wounded men marching before his eyes. What many of them had told him continued to reverberate through his mind.
"We fought for you, Shadeslayer." Whispers in the Night.
Roran opened his eyes and stared at the drooping canvas overhead. A thin, grey light pervaded the tent, leaching objects of their colour, rendering everything a pale shadow of its daylight self. He shivered. The blankets had slid down to his waist, exposing his torso to the cold night air. As he pulled them back up, he noticed that Katrina was no longer by his side. He saw her sitting by the entrance to the tent, staring up at the sky. She had a cloak wrapped over her shift. Her hair fell to the small of her back, a dark, tangled bramble. A lump formed in Roran's throat as he studied her. Dragging the blankets with him, he sat beside her. He placed an arm around her shoulders and she leaned against him, her head and neck warm against his chest. He kissed her on the brow. For a long while he contemplated the glimmering stars with her, and listened to the regular pattern of her breathing, the only sound besides his own in the sleeping world. Then she whispered,
"The constellations are shaped differently here. Have you noticed?"
"Aye." He shifted his arm, fitting it against the curve of her waist and feeling the slight bulge of her growing belly. "What woke you?" She shivered.
"I was thinking."
"Oh." Starlight gleamed in her eyes as she twisted in his arms and gazed at him.
"I was thinking about you and us, and our future together."
"Those are heavy thoughts for so late at night."
"Now that we are married, how do you plan to care for me and for our child?"
"Is that what worries you?"
He smiled.
"You won't starve. We have gold enough to assure that. Besides, the Varden will always see to it that Aragorn's cousins have food and shelter. Even if something were to happen to me, they would continue to provide for you and the baby."
"Yes, but what do you intend to do?"
Puzzled, he searched her face for the source of her agitation.
"I am going to help Aragorn end this war so we can return to Palancar Valley and settle down without fear of soldiers dragging us off to Urabain. What else would I do?"
"You will fight with the Varden, then?"
"You know I will."
"As you would have fought today, if Nasawada had let you?"
"Yes."
"What about baby, though? An army on the march is no place to raise a child."
"We cannot run away and hide from the Empire, Katrina. Unless the Varden win, Galbatorix will find and kill us, or he will find and kill our children or our children's children. And I do not think the Varden will achieve victory unless everyone does their utmost to help them."
She placed a finger over his lips.
"You are my only love. No other man shall ever capture my heart. I will do everything I can to lighten your burden. I will cook your meals, mend your clothes, and clean your armor. but once I give birth, I will leave this army.
Leave?
He went rigid.
That's nonsense. Where would you go?
Douth, perhaps. Remember, Lady Alaris offered a sanctuary, and some of our people are still there. I would not be alone.
If you think I'm going to let you and our newborn child go tramping across Alagasia by yourselves, then...
You don't need to shout.
I'm not...
Yes, you are. Clasping his hand between hers and pressing it against her heart, she said, It's not safe here. If it were only the two of us, I could accept the danger, but not when it is our baby who might die. I love you, Roran, I love you so much. But our child has to come before anything we want for ourselves. Otherwise, we do not deserve to be called parents.
Tears shone in her eyes, and he felt his own eyes dampen.
It was you, after all, who convinced me to leave Carvajal and hide in the spine when the soldiers attacked. This is no different.
The stars swam before Roran as his vision blurred. I would rather lose an arm than be parted from you again. Katrina began to cry then, her quiet sobs shaking his body.
I don't want to leave you either.
He tightened his embrace and rocked back and forth with her. When her weeping subsided, he whispered in her ear,
I would rather lose an arm than be parted from you. But I would rather die than allow anyone to hurt you or our child. If you are going to leave, you should leave now, while it's still easy for you to travel.
She shook her head.
No, I want Gertrude as my midwife. She's the only one I trust. Besides, if I have any difficulty, I would rather be here, where there are magicians trained in healing.
Nothing will go wrong, he said. As soon as our child is born, you will go to Aberon, not Douth. It is less likely to be attacked. And if Aberon becomes too dangerous, then you will go to the Beor Mountains and live with the dwarves. And if Galbatorix strikes at the dwarves, then you will go to the elves in Duweldenvarden. And if Galbatorix attacks Duweldenvarden, I will fly to the moon and raise our child among the spirits who inhabit the heavens.
And they will bow down to you and make you their queen as you deserve.
She snuggled closer to him. Together they sat and watched as one by one the stars vanished from the sky, obscured by the glow spreading in the east. When only the morning star remained, Roran said,
You know what this means, don't you?
What?
I'll just have to ensure we kill every last one of Galbatorix's soldiers, capture all the cities in the Empire, defeat Murtagh and Thorn, and behead Galbatorix and his turncoat dragon before your time comes. That way, there will be no need for you to go away.
She was silent for a moment, then said,
If you could, I would be very happy.
They were about to return to their cot, when out of the glimmering sky there sailed a miniature ship, woven of dry strips of grass. The ship hovered in front of their tent, rocking upon invisible waves of air, and almost seemed to be looking at them with its dragon-head-shaped prow. Roran froze, as did Katrina. Like a living creature, the ship darted across the path before their tent, then it swooped up and around, chasing an errant moth. When the moth escaped, the ship glided back toward the tent, stopping only inches from Katrina's face. Before Roran could decide if he should snatch the ship out of the air, it turned and flew off toward the morning star, vanishing once more into the endless ocean of the sky, leaving them to gaze after it in wonder.
Orders. Late that night, visions of death and violence gathered along the edges of Aragorn's dreams, threatening to overwhelm him with panic. He stirred with unease, wanting to break free but unable to do so. Brief, disjointed images of stabbing swords and screaming men and Murtagh's angry face flashed before his eyes. Then Aragorn felt Saphira enter his mind. She swept through his dreams like a great wind, brushing aside his looming nightmare. In the silence that followed, she whispered,
All is well, little one. Rest easy.
You are safe, and I am with you. Rest easy.
A sense of profound peace crept over Aragorn. He rolled over and drifted off into happier memories, comforted by his awareness of Saphira's presence. When Aragorn opened his eyes an hour before sunrise, he found himself lying underneath one of Saphira's vein-webbed wings. She had her tail wrapped around him, and her side was warm against his head. He smiled and crawled out from under her wing, even as she lifted her head and yawned.
"Good morning," he said.
She yawned again and stretched like a cat. Aragorn bathed, shaved with magic, cleaned the falchion's scabbard of dried blood from the previous day, and then dressed in one of his elf tunics. Once he was satisfied he was presentable, and Saphira had finished her tongue bath, they walked to Nasawada's pavilion. All six of the current shift of Nighthawks were standing outside, their seamed faces set into their usual grim expressions. Aragorn waited while a stocky dwarf announced them, then he entered the tent, and Saphira crawled around to the open panel where she could insert her head and participate in the discussion. Aragorn bowed to Nasawada where she sat in her high-backed chair, carved with blooming thistles.
"My lady, you asked me to come here to talk about my future. You said you had a most important mission for me."
"I did, and I do," said Nasawada. "Please, be seated."
She indicated a folding chair next to Aragorn. Tilting the sword at his waist so it would not catch, he settled into the chair.
"As you know, Galbatorix has sent battalions to the cities of Aros, Feinster, and Bellatona in an attempt to prevent us from taking them by siege, or, failing that, to slow our progress and force us to divide our own troops, so we would be more vulnerable to the depredations of the soldiers who are camped north of us. After yesterday's battle, our scouts reported that the last of Galbatorix's men withdrew to parts unknown. I was going to strike at those soldiers days ago, but I had to refrain, since you were absent. Without you, Murtagh and Thorn could have slaughtered our warriors with impunity, and we had no way of discovering whether the two of them were among the soldiers. Now that you are with us again, our position is somewhat improved, although not as much as I had hoped, given that we must now also contend with Galbatorix's latest artifice, these men without pain. Our only encouragement is that the two of you, along with Islanzadi's spellcasters, have proved you can fend off Murtagh and Thorn. Upon that hope depends our plan for victory."
"That red runt is no match for me," said Saphira. "If he did not have Murtagh protecting him, I would trap him against the ground and shake him by the neck until he submitted to me and acknowledged me as leader of the hunt."
"I am sure you would," said Nasawada, smiling.
Aragorn asked, "What course of action have you decided upon, then?"
"I have decided upon several courses, and we must undertake them all simultaneously if any are to be successful. First, we cannot push farther into the Empire, leaving cities behind us that Galbatorix still controls. To do that would be to expose ourselves to attacks from both the front and the rear, and to invite Galbatorix to invade and seize Surda while we were absent. So I have already ordered the Varden to march north, to the nearest place where we can safely cross the Jeet River. Once we are on the other side of the river, I will send warriors south to capture Aros, while King Orin and I continue with the remainder of our forces to Feinster, which, with your help and Saphira's, should fall before us without too much trouble. While we are engaged in the tedious business of tramping across the countryside, I have other responsibilities for you, Aragorn."
She leaned forward in her seat.
"We need the full help of the dwarves. The elves are fighting for us in the north of Alagaesia. The Cerdans have joined with us body and mind, and even the Urgals have allied themselves with us. But we need the dwarves. We cannot succeed without them, especially now that we must contend with soldiers who cannot feel pain. Have the dwarves chosen a new king or queen yet?"
Nasawada grimaced.
Nahim assures me that the process is moving apace. But like the elves, dwarves take a longer view of time than we do. Apace for them might mean months of deliberations. Don't they really?